Parking at the dock was impossible, and time was pressing, so Bolin placed a government business card in the window and parked in a fire zone near a hydrant. Putting on a pair of dime store glasses, he carefully attached a small mustache to his upper lip, then checked his reflection in the mirror against the picture on a new FBI commission booklet. Not a perfect match, but that made it appear to be real. It would do. Briskly cutting through the crowds, a couple of stevedores gave Bolin a hard look, then shrugged and went on with their work. The smell of salt was strong in the air. Wooden crates and steel cargo containers were stacked to the sky in the yard of the docks. The dockyard was huge, extending for dozens of blocks along the coast. So the soldier did the sensible thing and went to the harbor master office. Controlled chaos, that was the only possible description, Bolin thought. If the sub was still in a slip somewhere, the master would know its exact location. No sense searching for a needle in a haystack when you could simply ask the farmer. Large signs pointed the way, and he soon located the office in a three-story building with a roof covered with microwave receivers and radio antennas. Shielding his face with a raised hand, Bolin looked between the fingers to see a roiling fireball rise over the buildings from the south side of the bay, a corona of debris flying wide and high, black specks in the air that resembled people and vehicles. Secondary detonations were to be expected in a blast that powerful, but the executioner felt his blood run cold as he slowly raised his wrist to check the Geiger counter. If that was a Zodiac, then he was a dead man already. Time stood still as he waited a few seconds to get a reading. The CIA device was only registering nothing out of the ordinary. It wasn't a nuke. A blurred motion overhead caught Bolin's attention, and he sprinted forward to grab a man and forcibly drag him out of a forklift.
Incoming! Get down!
A dozen or so men and women lurched into action, dragging friends underneath concrete lintels and behind brick walls. A man wriggled as a steel rod speared him through the chest, still alive but impaled like an insect on a pin. The unmanned, burning forklift continued to roll until it collided with a wall.
Take cover!
A swarm of falling litter rained upon a Quonset hut, punching straight through the corrugated steel roof. A burning man appeared from nowhere. A dock worker with a fire extinguisher sprayed him down as sirens approached the dockyard. Bolin's guts tightened as a mushroom cloud began to form above the distant conflagration. Almost any ground fire would create that effect if it was hot enough, but the sight was still unnerving, a hellish reminder of exactly what could have happened here. There was no doubt in his mind that the explosions had been caused by the Scion. Their sub was here, and something major had exploded. There had to be a connection, and the last place to find out anything would be the blast zone itself. Zalhares would have been well away before igniting a blast of this magnitude. Watching for falling debris, Bolin moved quickly through the crowd to reach the exposed brick staircase that led to the third-story office of the harbormaster. Time was against him, and this was his best chance to get the information he needed. Bolin tried to stay out of the way of the rescue operation. This was a battle zone, the same as the jungles of Vietnam or the deserts of Iran. Chaos and blood, but with a core of professionals moving through the madness, employing their training. A wooden railing encircled the third floor, the outer walls composed of huge plexiglass windows to give a panoramic view of the harbor and the hundreds of ships moored at the complex docking facilities. Most of the windows were intact. Only those facing south were destroyed, lying across desks, smashed computers, and fallen file cabinets like a lake of ice blown into the rooms by the concussion of the first explosion. Bolin found a pretty young woman at the reception desk, a janitor expertly bandaging her head with strips of cloth. Lying on the dirty carpet nearby was a still form, covered by a suit jacket, the material soaked through with blood. Proceeding deeper into the offices, Bolin grabbed a disheveled man by the arm, but the fellow only stared back, desperately cleaving to a ream of copier paper. After a moment, Bolin released the man and watched as he shuffled away, clutching the ream as if it were the most important thing in the world. Bolin recognized the symptoms as shell shock, his mind gone for the time being from the harsh reality of so many violent deaths. He had seen it before in combat, and knew the man would be fine again after an extended period of peace and quiet. Most of the other rooms were deserted, but at the end of the corridor there was a large office with a wide view of the harbor. Fire tugs were cutting across the waves, heading for the rampaging maelstrom to the south, the black cloud spreading over the yard like a death shroud. A woman in utility green clothing was shouting into a telephone.
What in the hell do you mean you didn't hear it? I would have thought the concussion would have blown the governor off his chair in Tallahassee. Lost every window we have facing south, and yes, we have casualties, you freaking moron. Dozens are dead, maybe more. The place is a disaster zone. What was that? No, send us everything you can spare. Medical helicopters, National Guard, the works. And move fast or I'll be using your balls for bait. Well, the incompetent slack asses to be manning a phone line.
She opened a desk drawer and produced a Smith & Wesson 38 revolver. With sure fingers, she ripped open a cardboard box of ammunition and started loading the cylinder. Protection against looters. Smart move. The dock would have security personnel, but who knew if they were alive, much less functioning at the moment.
Excuse me, are you the harbor master? Miss, are you the harbor master?
Yeah, I'm in charge here. Assistant harbor master, Rebecca Weeks. Hell of a time for the boss to go on vacation, eh? So, who the hell are you and what are you doing in my office?
Special Agent Matthew Cooper. I need some information.
Now? You've got to be kidding.
It's important.
No, the fire is important. Oh, crap. Is this the work of terrorists? Is that what we got here?
I don't know yet. What's been blown up?
Hell, what hasn't? Looks like the big explosion was the main fuel storage tanks, but I can't say for sure yet.
Diesel?
No, those are over there. That was the gas tanks. We keep them separate for safety reasons. Thank God for that.
But Bolin frowned at the news. Could he be wrong? The Zwardvis-class sub was a diesel, so there was no reason for it to take on gasoline as fuel. Maybe this was only a diversion so the Scion could leave unnoticed.
Look, I'm busy. So grab a fire jacket and lend some help or come back some other time.
I'll wait.
Wait? This could take days to sort out. It could take weeks.
Bolin merely smiled in reply. Casting a look at a closed safe in the corner where she kept the petty cash, Weeks frowned, then took a handheld radio from a recharging rack on the wall and strode outside. Bolin waited until the office was clear, then set to work on the file cabinets. The folders were up to date and in alphabetical order. There were three submarines in port, a DVR doing some salvage for the U.S. Navy, an oceanographic vessel for a marine biology firm in Los Angeles, and a cargo carrier, the RDN Zwardvis. The captain had paid the docking charges in cash. There'd been no request for supplies or even line charges for using the local electricity. That's when he saw it. The only other charge was for 16,000 gallons of gasoline. There was even a memo from the fuel station operator that he thought it odd for a sub to run on gasoline, but since only an idiot would fill a diesel with gasoline, the engines had to have been modified for some reason. Angrily, Bolin looked out the window at the chaos below. They rigged the sub to blow. They even filled the tanks with gasoline to make the blast that much bigger. Their one conspicuous mistake had been paying in cash, and they had probably done that to avoid using a credit card and leaving a trail for the CIA to trace. However, that only forced each harbor to fax a receipt to the home office for the company records. On a hunch, Bolin pulled out the signed faxes from Black River and compared the signatures. They were different. The man who signed as the captain in Newfoundland wasn't the same person who signed in Miami today, which likely meant the original Taiwanese captain was dead, along with most, if not all, of the crew. Bolin surmised that the captain had discovered what he was hauling, had decided to pressure for a larger fee, and the Scion had taken over the sub. Brazil had a submarine fleet, 24 or so vessels, so it was possible that at least one member of the Scion knew how to operate the ship. They could have also kept a couple of members of the crew alive, at least for a while. Bolin knew that Zalharis wouldn't cause a disturbance like this if he was planning on traveling through Miami. Homeland Security, FBI, state and city police were on terrorist watch by now, sealing the airports and train stations, with the Coast Guard and U.S. Navy moving in to cover the ports and dockyards, which meant the Scion was already long gone. They would be at sea again on a speedboat or a yacht, something fast that they could land easily. Simply set the sub to blow, choose their craft, kill the crew, and sail away as the dockyard went up in flames, the blast removing every trace of the killings and theft. Bolin looked out to see National Guard copters starting to land on the dock to carry away the worst of the wounded. The Miami Emergency Measures team moved fast. Turning away from the turmoil, Bolin scrutinized the peaceful city of Miami, its hotels standing along the coastline like the remains of some prehistoric wall built to hold back the sea. The golden sands of the beaches were coated with people enjoying their vacations, retired couples, young families, 10,000 college kids, each of them a shield for the Scion to hide behind. Any move on the part of the military placed those innocent lives in terrible jeopardy. And the nukes had been here. A million civilian lives in danger, and Bolin had been one deadly step behind the Scion.
Excuse, please.
Assuming a friendly smile, Bolin turned to see a large, burly man standing at the open door. Bolin instantly recognized him as the gunman from Liberty City.
I'm looking for the harbor master. Holy shit, it's you!
He staggered, but didn't fall.
Freeze or die. Your call.
His face a mask of hatred, the stranger stayed where he was, leaning against the wall with one hand holding his no doubt aching guts.
Empty your pockets.
Go ahead and shoot. I have nothing to...
Rifling through his adversary's pockets after pistol-whipping him, Bolin found an Imbel pistol in a double shoulder holster and a Remington 44 Derringer tucked up his sleeve in a trick slide. A CIA invention abandoned decades ago, Bolin knew of only one nation that still used the gimmick, Brazil. Not surprisingly, the man's watch was also a Geiger counter. There was a miniature blade hidden inside his wallet, along with a key perfect for police handcuffs, and several $100 in large bills. He also had a money belt carrying thousands more, and several passports from an assortment of countries, each made out to a different name. Jose Ramirez from Mexico, Adolfo Lars from Spain, and so on. Bolin unbuttoned the man's shirt to expose a bulletproof vest, the quilted Teflon garment dotted with flattened 9mm slugs. Bolin cut away the garment and found one more passport taped to the badly bruised flesh underneath. Keeping careful watch on the stirring prisoner, the executioner stepped back to examine the hidden passport. It had been issued by the Brazilian Federal Police, Department S2, to a Miguel Santarino. The picture matched, and the country stamps showed he traveled extensively in South America, but had recently been to England and Newfoundland. Removing one of the man's shoes, Bolin pulled up a chair to wait for Santarino to awaken. After a few minutes, the soldier impatiently got a paper cup of water from the cooler.
Where are my guns? Why didn't you kill me?
Because we're after the same people.
Good, then we are allies. You took one of my shoes. Why?
Damn difficult to rush someone when you're off balance like that, isn't it?
You're not wrong.
Santarino crossed both legs with the practiced ease of a yogi. But his right hand moved too quickly over a pant cuff, and Bolin extended the Beretta to point-blank range. Without any change of expression, Santarino dropped a throwing spike onto the floor, its tip glistening with some greenish chemical.
Can't blame a man for trying. Your suitcase is a decoy for the Zodiac, isn't it? Not bad. Here's hoping you'll get the chance to make a switch.
Studying the S2 agent carefully, Bolin felt as if he were defusing a landmine. This was a dangerous man.
Listen. Your team has gone rogue. The captain and crew of the sub are dead, and Zalhares has taken the cargo for himself.
Who?
Don't waste my time, Miguel.
And what makes you think the Scion works for us? Where is your proof?
I don't need any.
And you're not FBI, despite the badge in your pocket?
No, I'm not.
Ah, I was unaware that the United States also had a secret police force. Unless I'm mistaken, in which case, neither of us truly belongs here.
Bolin smiled coldly in return, and the man frowned, unsure if his remark had scored a bullseye or not. The American was revealing nothing.
We do not approve of the cargo. The Scion was to infiltrate the CIA and relay political information to us, nothing more. This theft was entirely the plan of Sorrelu Zalhares. My nation has its own program to develop such weapons, and does not wish to make America an enemy. If we accept delivery of the items, the United States will cancel its trade agreements with Brazil. My country would lose billions for stealing weapons worth only a few million.
Try again. The Zodiacs are priceless because the atomic signature of nuclear weapons is easily identifiable by satellites in space. These are more than just stolen nukes. They're American nukes. If Brazil used them to obliterate a rebel stronghold, no revolutionary force would ever dare to attack you again. But we would get all the blame.
That theory has some small amount of merit. But then the financial wrath of America would be crippling. America is rich, Brazil is not. No. If the weapons came to us, we would be forced to give them back purely for the sake of our political survival. It isn't worth the trouble.
Bolin could see that the man was telling the truth. So the Scion was on the run from the most powerful nation in the world and the most ruthless. Brazil made China look like Canada when it came to murdering its own citizens, which also meant Zaljares was cut off from his official sources and would need to make new contacts for weapons, revenue, and contacts to sell the nukes. Bolin also knew for a fact that the S2 agent would likely kill him the moment he could. But until then, they were uneasy allies. With the decision made, Bolin lowered the Beretta.
You can have your shoe back, Miguel. We're done here.
Nodding in agreement, Santorino tugged on his shoe and started to reach for the pile of his weapons.
Not so fast. Leave them. I'm sure you have more.
Turning his back on Bolin, Santorino walked stiffly to the door and worked the latch, then paused, the firelight from outside coloring his pitted features like an autumn moon.
I must be the one to kill Cerrero. You may have the others, but Cerrero is mine.
No promises. What they carry is mine. Don't get in the way of my getting it back. And afterward, I'll gift wrap Zaljares for you and the S2 boys to play with in the back room all you want. Understood?
Watching until the giant man walked down the hall and disappeared down the stairs, Bolin gathered the rest of the weapons, tucking them into the accordion pouch inside the briefcase. Crossing the office, he laid the money belt on the desk of the harbormaster. The few $1,000 wouldn't go very far in the rebuilding, but every little bit helped. Bolin studied the milling crowd below. Santorino's size made him stick out, and the soldier watched through a window as the big S2 agent disappeared into the rolling smoke. He wasn't sure if he had made an ally or a new enemy, but either way, the heat had just been turned up on the Scion. Carmen Delahunt was grimly patrolling the internet for any sign of the Scion. Brushing away a loose strand of her fiery red hair, the woman adjusted her virtual reality visor, surfing for any abnormalities. With the theft of the Zodiacs, she had fed 100 keywords into search programs being run by the massive bank of Cray SV2 supercomputers located under the farm's annex computer room. Anybody sending email, an IM, graphics, visual, or vocal transmissions on the web that used a combination of any two or more of the keywords would trigger an automatic trace. So far, the net was clear, with only a few odd coincidences that she was trying to track down, but without much success. Ultra small and super fast, the microtransmissions were gone in a nanosecond, and even her extensive software couldn't nail them without help. A distinguished-looking man entered the room, chewing on the stem of a pipe. Smoking was forbidden in the computer room, but Huntington Hunt Weathers still enjoyed the feel and smell of the pipe, even when he couldn't light his favorite briarwood. He crossed to his workstation to review the work in progress. After assuming control of a NORAD military satellite, Weathers unleashed specially designed software to gather information for Brugnola. Aaron Kurtzman wheeled into the lab, a safety mug of coffee perched on his lap.
Fresh coffee, anybody?
Akira Takedo never looked up from his screen. You make coffee?
Of course.
Then no thanks.
I have plans to live long enough to see my children graduate college, and that concoction you call coffee won't help me make it there alive.
Nonsense. This is real coffee. The good stuff. Kills every germ known to science and puts hair on your chest.
Arching an eyebrow, Delahunt demurely ran a finger along the neckline of her blouse, exposing a hint of cleavage.
Oh, just try some. You'll never have to buy another sweater.
Now there's a splendid visual. Pass. Huh. That's curious. There it is again.
Trouble?
Could be. I just had another T-burst. That's the third within an hour.
A T-burst was the newest scourge of the internet, a computerized version of a blip transmission over a radio. A massive amount of information condensed into a small tone that lasted for only a second, sometimes even less. There were a lot of heavily encrypted transmissions being sent online, and every one of them had a fake ID and source code. Something big was going down in the cyber world, and that was always trouble.
Did you get a recording? I'm slaving my console to yours.
Of course. But it's heavily protected, quadruple layers. Weird stuff. Bear, I need a Cray assigned to handle just this data, or else it will take me a week to bust the code.
If ever. I'm not familiar with this configuration of encryption.
Could it be about the Zodiacs?
Damned if I know. Not yet, at least.
Number 3 is yours. Get cracking.
Would you care for some assistance?
All I can get. I'm going back in with the VR.
The Cessna Skylane buzzed across the blue sky. Sitting behind the steering yoke, Mac Bolan adjusted his sunglasses and checked the altimeter to make sure he was maintaining the assigned height of 5,000 feet above the Gulf of Mexico. The sky was clear, and a gentle southerly wind blew steadily at 5 knots. Excellent flying weather. Glancing at the military radar, Bolan saw that the Doppler screen was clear, as was the computer-enhanced civilian KNH-880 multi-hazard warning system. He was alone in the sky, except for some commercial jetliners 20,000 feet above. The problem was down below. The fires were still raging at the Biscayne Dockyard, and so far, more than 100 assorted crafts were unaccounted for. Ignoring the smaller speedboats, the odd hovercrafts and such, Bolan chose to concentrate on the seagoing yachts. They had long range and lots of room below decks. Zalares wouldn't have taken a full yacht. Those 200-footers always carried an armed crew in case of pirate attacks. That would have been too much trouble to try and steal quietly in the middle of a busy harbor. No, they would have gone for something smaller, say a 50-foot yacht, certainly no larger than a 75. These days, every yacht had a lowjack built into its hull, a hidden radio set to broadcast its location in case of theft. However, the lowjack couldn't be turned on until the yacht was reported stolen to its security company. And with most of the owners dead or hospitalized, that wasn't likely. Bolan had asked Brugnola to turn over every lowjack off the coast of the Miami area and to have the computers at the farm start removing the legitimate signals. In less than an hour, the list had been reduced to a mere handful. 3 that seemed just out for a pleasure ride going nowhere, 2 headed in the general direction of the Cayman Islands, 1 heading east into the Atlantic Ocean, and 1 heading full speed towards Jamaica. Unfortunately, there was no way of telling which it might be aside from monitoring the progress of the yachts, or having the spy satellites in orbit do a visual recon with their telescopes, which was taking far longer than Bolan hoped for. Most of the satellites had already been on assignments, monitoring troop movements in Cuba or drug shipments in Colombia, and had to be realigned. That took time, and then a visual recon would only tell them who was on the deck, not down in the hold.
Calling Hawk 1. Hawk 1, come in, please. This is Uncle Harry. Over.
I read you loud and clear, Harry. How's the fishing? Over.
Not so good. Go to setting 2. Over.
Setting 2. Confirm.
Even using codes, it was foolish to give the setting. This hour, they went up 1 every time they used the radio. In the next hour, it would be down 2. There were a lot of electronic ears in this part of the world, and most of them weren't friendly. It paid to be careful.
Okay, Hal, do you read me?
Like you are in the next room. Okay, the news isn't good. The SATs checked the yacht heading for Jamaica, and unless our runners have hired a dozen teenage girls as cover, it's exactly what it seems to be. A party boat full of drunk college students heading for fun in the sun.
That leaves 5, then. I'm heading for the Caymans. Can you get a pass on the other 4?
The declination of the watchdogs is already being changed by the NSA to check that wild card heading into the Atlantic. Although they're pissing blood over not being told why. But that's good for them to be knocked down a peg or two every now and then. Keep them humble. I'll let you know once we have a visual.
Roger that, Hal. Good luck. I'll report every hour until I hear from you. Over and out.
With no exact destination, Bolan was currently headed for the Caymans to refuel. The islands were a good rendezvous point for any criminal activity in the Gulf of Mexico. The small country had no military at all, only the Royal Cayman Island Police, with a few assault rifles, some rescue boats, and that was about it. But then an armed military wasn't really needed, as people rarely attacked their own bank. A former British territory, now a free state, the Cayman Islands had no marketable crops, no natural supply of clean water, no minerals to mine, no manufacturing, no heavy industry, and yet its population had the highest standard of living in the entire world. That was because the Caymans were the money laundering capital of the world. The vacation paradise was in truth a secluded hellhole of vice and murder. There were a lot of honest cops who thought blowing the islands off the map would cripple every criminal operation in the world for the next decade, and Bolan heartily agreed. Years ago, he'd been there on a rescue mission that had turned out to be a lot more difficult than expected. But it gave him an intimate knowledge of the islands. The capital city, Georgetown, had the best airport, absolutely state-of-the-art comfort and efficiency, but also tight security, so Bolan optioned on refueling at a private airport on the lesser island.
Things were more lax off the main island, and a fistful of cash averted the attention of the local police with no questions asked. As Bolin settled down for the long flight, the radar screen rippled and went blank. Reaching for the reset button, he frowned as the KMH went down. Quickly pulling out his cell phone, Bolin got the same results. There was a jamming field working in the area, covering the full EM spectrum. That took considerable power and equipment. After checking the Desert Eagle strapped under his windbreaker, Bolin pulled out some Navy field glasses and swept the ocean for any yachts below, but the water was clear. Something eclipsed the sun, and Bolin automatically veered off into a steep dive. He glanced out the rear window to see that a C-130 Hercules transport had nearly crashed into him. If the pilot had wanted Bolin dead, he merely needed to cut a tight pass, and the turbulence of the gigantic propeller-driven behemoth would send the plane into a tailspin that would end in a watery crash. Moving fast, Bolin threw the joystick to the left and angled into a dive. Coming up the locking mechanism, Bolin slid open the small access window. Tilting the Cessna slightly, he caught sight of the Hercules and banked into a sharp turn. This was going to require some precise timing.
I knew I'd packed grenades for a reason.
His briefcase lay on the passenger seat. Keeping one hand tight on the yoke, he armed the bomb and dropped it out the side window.
Damn wind shear. Take that into account.
Only two more grenades remained in the briefcase, so he chose a canister charge and waited a moment after pulling the pin before dropping the bomb out the window. It was an incredibly near miss. In response, the Hercules slowly turned sideways, showing its left side to Bolin. As he watched, the access door slid back to reveal two men with safety lines around their waists and an M60 machine gun attached somehow to the floor. The incoming barrage missed the tiny Cessna completely as Bolin flipped his belly to the Hercules and cut away in a hard turn.
Damn it!
The Hercules' rear cargo hatch began to lower. Knowing what to expect, Bolin was already climbing above when a group of men appeared in the hatch, connected to a spider web of safety lines. 10, 12 armed soldiers, maybe more, it was hard to tell, with their clothing whipping madly. Pushing the Cessna engine, Bolin managed to catch the wind and get above the Hercules. Swinging the monoplane back and forth, he quickly reviewed his options as the Hercules started to pull away in front. There were a dozen or more men with automatic weapons, more than enough to tear the Cessna apart once they got the range, and only one grenade left, a smoke canister he was saving to pretend the Cessna was on fire and crash it into the right yacht. Plummeting into the sea was fast becoming a real possibility. There were two C-4 blocks still wired to the remote detonator in the briefcase, which would blow the Hercules in two if he could get it through the open hatchway. But the accuracy of such a lob was impossible. On top of which, with the jamming field in place, the plastique couldn't be triggered by a radio signal, and it would take far too long to disengage the wiring and reset the blocks for an impact detonation. Wheeling through the unfriendly skies, Bolin reviewed his combat options with lightning speed. His handguns lacked sufficient power to do any real damage to the Titanic airplane. But in the space behind the rear passenger seats was one of the equipment lockers, mostly containing small arms and extra ammunition. The other two trunks were stored in the aft baggage compartment. They might as well be on the moon for all the good they could do for the soldier right now. Small arms were all he had, but maybe the Sabre OICW could do the job. Looking around, Bolin saw the huge plane in a steep climb coming right at the Cessna. They were trying for a ram again. Slamming the yoke all the way forward, he did the unexpected and nosed into a full-power dive straight at the Hercules. For a moment, the two airplanes headed straight for one another, and Bolin got a fleeting glimpse of the pilot and co-pilot in the cockpit of the transport. The co-pilot was unknown, but the pilot was Miguel Santorino. Apparently, their truce was off before it ever really started. Waiting until the very last moment, Bolin cut the dive into a bank and dropped his port flap to skim sideways beneath the Hercules and avoid the gunman in the rear.
Come on, come on.
Then he was past the winged behemoth and heading almost straight for the silvery waters of the Gulf. Leveling the flaps, Bolin feathered his props, then fed the engine more power and started to pull back on the yoke to fight the descent. Pushed to its limits, the sturdy engine almost stalled from the conflicting G-forces, and the waves of the ocean came sharply into focus before he could feel the plane start to rise again to fly level above the Gulf. Bolin started climbing for distance, pushing the Cessna for the maximum ceiling of 10,000 feet. Safe for a moment, he flexed his hands on the yoke. That suicide maneuver had bought him a few minutes, but Santorino wouldn't fall for the trick again. Next time, the S2 agent would have his people ready to drop grenades as the Cessna cut under the wings that would settle the matter permanently. Bolin knew that he was in a bad spot. The Hercules was faster in straight flight than the Cessna, its four huge engines easily overpowering his one-lung 230. Plus, the mighty Herc could climb higher at greater range and firepower. There was no way the Cessna could escape, but there were a few points in his favor. The Hercules had only one big hatch in the rear that its crew could safely use to shoot from, and the open doorway with the M60 machine gun. With both of those wide open, the plane was taking in a lot of drag and was slowing it. And since this seemed to be a civilian model, there was no access door on the right side, so the Hercules had a blind side. That was good news. Even better was that the Cessna cockpit was small enough for Boland to fire out both side windows, doubling his attack options. Also, the little monoplane was a lot more maneuverable than a lumbering transport. Boland didn't have much of an edge, but it was something. Reviewing the plane for any damage, Boland checked the engine temperature, gas, and oil. The Cessna had a few holes in it, but was otherwise fine. Setting the autopilot for full speed in a gentle climb, he unbuckled the seatbelt. The armor-piercing Law rocket would blast a hole in the Hercules large enough to drive a Hummer through, but the back blast from the tube would blow the Cessna apart. It couldn't be used from inside the plane. Laying the Law next to a parachute, Boland went back to the trunk and chose his best weapon for this flight, a brand new state-of-the-art gun called a Sabre. Looking like something from a sci-fi movie, the Sabre had two barrels and one trigger, a thumb switch on the frame controlling which of the weapons would be used. The main barrel fired 5.56mm hardball ammo with a standard 30-round clip. The second, fatter barrel, was located directly above the machine gun and launched 20mm grenades, fed by a 6-round clip. The scope had all sorts of impressive night vision and computer-enhanced utilities, but those were useless in Boland's current situation. Boland returned to the pilot's seat just in time to see the Hercules rise on his side like some leviathan from the depths. Never before had the soldier truly appreciated just how large the plane was. Thankfully, he couldn't see any Bofor cannon barrels sticking out of the nose gun ports. If Santorino was armed with those, Boland would have no choice but to jump and risk setting his parachute on fire when he launched the Law. And although the giant plane carried Brazilian markings, it was a civilian model, unarmed on the exterior. The tracers stitched a bright line across the sky, curving into the wind and away from the enemy plane.
Come on, damn it!
The ammo didn't achieve penetration, merely splattered on the surface. Now the gunman had a clear view. Thumbing the selector switch, the executioner pumped out a grenade that directly hit one of the gunmen standing in the open hatchway. There was no explosion. The man staggered and fell backward into the plane.
Damn! That was a stun shot I was saving for Zalhares.
Hold it. Boland's Cessna slipped sideways over the Hercules, then sloped sharply to the right, reaching the blind side of the Hercules.
Peekaboo, you sorry sons of bitches.
Boland volleyed the Sabre's remaining 20mm rounds at the behemoth. The first two hit on the air, but then one of the engine cowlings exploded to fall away, revealing the naked machinery. Boland peppered the engine until it caught on fire, thick orange flames whipping back in the wind. The Hercules slowed as the propeller went dead. Then foam gushed over the burning machinery, drowning the flames.
At first you don't succeed.
Boland tried for the other engine, but only blew holes in the main fuselage just behind the bank of windows that framed the main cockpit. With his bare arm sticking outside the plane, Santorino was firing an SMG at the Cessna. Boland concentrated the 5.56mm rounds on the blast holes in the hull. Unlike the glass in the Cessna, the Hercules windows would be nearly bulletproof, accommodating the higher wing pressures it was designed for. Boland lowered the flaps and tried to outdistance any possible response from the tail. The cargo ramp was set below the tail section, and back there, the Hercules had another small blind spot. But staying in the protective shadow of the moving tail was difficult, and every time the Cessna came into view, the Brazilians opened up again. Momentarily blinded, Boland reacted instinctively and sent the Cessna into a circling dive. The enemy was shooting flares to get the wind. He had managed to hurt them, but now the Brazilians were coming in for the kill. With one engine dead, plus the drag, the Cessna and the Hercules were roughly capable of the same speed now, so escape was an option. But if he did, Santorino would be on his tail every step of the way. Boland had offered a truce, but Santorino had chosen death instead. So be it. Time for him to pay the price of that decision. Boland's scored a couple of hits in the top of the tail section, damaging the rudder, and bluish smoke started to pour from the rear hatch. The color of the smoke told it was an oil fire. Maybe he had set fire to one of the vehicles parked inside, or caught an auxiliary pressure line. Either way, an oil fire was hard to control, and the gunman in the aft section would be nearly blind and choking on the fumes. A chance round pinged off one of the Cessna floats. Dropping to the right side behind the Hercules, the soldier peppered the craft with 5.56mm rounds, the tracers curving in the wind to impact all over the slowing plane. Tiny dots of fire now clung to the hull, and the smoke from the rear was becoming more pronounced.
Stryker, do you read me? Damn it to hell, Stryker, do you hear me? Over!
Keeping a tight grip on the yoke, Boland started to reach for the hand mic. Something heavy hit the roof of the Cessna. Had they dumped a wounded man to save on weight? No, that lump on his back was a parachute, and the man seemed to be holding a long tube in his arms. That was a stinger. Dropping the saber, Boland grabbed the emergency flare pistol from its pocket holster located under the dash. Even as Boland shoved the pistol through the left window, the falling man became enshrouded in smoke, and a rocket shot out of the tube to climb fast on a stiletto of flame. Forcing himself to remain calm, Boland waited long seconds as the Stinger anti-aircraft missile zoomed toward the Cessna. Then he gently squeezed the trigger. The pistol thumped, and the signal flare streaked away for the incoming Stinger. At first, it looked as if the ploy wasn't going to work. Then the heatseeker sharply veered its course toward the sizzling flare. Instantly, Boland slammed the joystick forward and gave the Cessna full power, angling into a dive once more and racing for distance.
Come on, baby. Come on.
Stryker, do you copy?
The Cessna violently shook as one of the wing struts bent slightly and a dozen small holes appeared in the fuselage and floor. The back of his seat jerked, and an object jabbed him hard in the ribs, but there was no stab of pain. Reaching down, he gingerly felt the seat to find a hot dent in the metal backing, saved by a scant millimeter of cheap steel. Dropping speed to match the crippled Hercules, Boland ignored the 9mm rounds coming from Santorino and made a slow sweep across the damaged right wing, the 20mm rounds blowing holes in the surface, shearing off an airfoil flap, and then a wing tank caught fire. He banked away sharply and fed the Cessna full power. The Cessna shook so hard, the rear window and the dashboard radar screen both cracked. For a moment, he thought his luck had gone, and the plane would crumple like a stepped-on tin can. Boland grabbed the yoke with both hands and tried to ride out the balance of the blast as best he could. A piece of flaming wreckage shot by. On the dashboard, a warning light flashed. As a fuel line cracked, a pinkish spray shooting out of the dented cowling. Gritting his teeth, Boland strained to keep the plane on course as he reached out to flip a switch to close the ruptured gas line fast. The hydraulic pressure was dropping like a stone, but before he could do anything, it leveled out, the needle hovering just above the red zone. The Cessna lurched as the float broke free and the monoplane tilted to the left. Fighting the wounded plane into a level flight path, Boland risked a gentle turn in the sky and caught a glimpse of the last few pieces of the burning Hercules tumbling into the ocean. Scanning the sky, he saw no parachutes drifting downward, but there still might be survivors. With a float missing, he couldn't land the seaplane on water, but Boland decided to do a recon. Boland guided the Cessna lower and circled the crash area twice, looking for signs of swimmers. But there was nothing aside from the soggy white parachute of the man who had jumped out to launch the Stinger. The material drifted listlessly in the currents and was slowly starting to sink under its own wet weight. Briefly, Boland wondered if the lunatic who jumped had been Santorino. Then he pushed the matter from his mind and picked up the hand mic.
Hawk One, Uncle Harry.
Stryker, thank God. Where the hell have you been?
Switching to Seven.
Okay, we're secure. Now what's going on? You haven't answered my hails for the past hour.
I was busy. Our friends dropped by, but they're no longer coming to the party.
Alphabet friends, I'll wager. Letter and a number.
Roger that, Hal. Any news on the yachts?
Yes, they're all clean, which means any of them could have a Scion below decks. Or else we screwed the pooch and they escaped some other way.
They used a yacht, Hal. Trust me on this. The S2 wouldn't have been out here just gunning for me. They have a major hard-on for Zalhares for political reasons.
I hear you. I'll let you know if anything turns up.
Roger on that, Hal. Over and out.
Boland concentrated on heading for the Cayman Islands. His fuel was low, but it should be enough. With the S2 out of the way, there was nothing standing between him and Zalhares but a few miles of empty air. He Evening was starting to fall, the sky turning glorious purple on its way to the deep black of night. As the green Ford van's headlights swept along the uneven road, there appeared in the distance a large, wooden, hand-painted sign with the name of a bar, bright halogen lights illuminating it for drivers to see for miles.
Let's go. We haven't much time.
Slinging an Uru over a shoulder, Georgina Mizne went to the wooden sign and put a short burst of 9mm rounds into the electrical box at the base of the main support beam. The woman then pulled a hatchet from a sheath on her belt and went to the first wooden support. She frowned, put the axe away, and leveled the Uru. Her first strident burst chewed partially through the thick oak beam, and the sign began to sag slightly. Meanwhile, Dog Mariano and Minas Pedrosa hammered a steel rod into the hard berm alongside the paved roadway. Walking across the dirt turnoff, they dragged a chain and attached it to another steel rod they had installed. Dangling from the chain at windshield level was a sign saying in English and Spanish that the road was temporarily closed for repairs. As the trio returned to the truck, Zalhares, having just emptied a bag of caltrops onto the ground, was using his boot to scatter them around. Invented by the ancient Romans, a caltrop was a hard piece of wood with several nails driven through at different angles, so that an array of sharp steel points always jutted upward no matter how the wood rolled. Originally used 2,000 years ago to stop barefoot barbarians, the ancient caltrops worked equally well against inflatable car tires. Mariano and Pedrosa were in their seats waiting patiently, along with Mizne. The van, a recent acquisition, had cost a small fortune, but it was well worth the expense. The outside was worn and slightly rusted, giving it a used appearance, but the vehicle was brand new, modified heavily with body armor, an oversized engine, and extra heavy-duty springs in the rear to help handle the load. The small lead safe bolted into the rear. Harris froze as a car approached the turnoff. It went by without even slowing and vanished behind a low rolling hill of the desert.
Wretched place. How can people live without trees?
Who cares? Soon enough we shall be back home and richer than Colombian drug lords.
They reached an oasis of illumination, a parking lot full of pickup trucks and motorcycles. And in the center was a squat brick building with a garish pink neon sign proclaiming the name of the bar, Fat Ed's. Pretending to look for a parking space, Zalhares circled the bar once, doing a recon, then parked directly in front alongside a row of motorcycles. Lurching away from a yucca tree, a fat man smoking a hand-rolled cigarette swaggered over to the van, both thumbs tucked inside his wide garrison belt.
You can't park there, jackass! This is for hogs only!
Climbing out of their Ford, the members of Scion checked their weapons as they listened to the night for a moment, ignoring the music that they could now feel pulsating against their bare skin. Gesturing with a free hand, Zalhares sent Mariano to the left and Pedrosa to the right. Drawing their silenced Imbel automatic pistols, the men disappeared around the building, then reappeared a few minutes later, easing fresh clips into their hot weapons. A drunken man and two female companions came out through the door. In practiced ease, the Scion stepped back until the drunk people cleared the doorway, then trained their silenced weapons directly at the backs of their heads. The Scion waited for any reaction from the other cars. When no response came, they pushed inside the bar. The bar was full, with crowded tables covering the floor and a line of people standing at a counter in the rear. Huge black speakers, nearly as large as refrigerators, were set into the ceiling, and posters of rock bands and famous outlaws from the Old West decorated the brick walls. Ceiling fans valiantly tried to circulate the smoky air, and the floor was covered with a thick layer of crushed peanut shells. There was no other exit in sight. They spread out in a firing line, looking for danger spots and marking their targets. At a table nearby, a drunken blonde stopped bobbing her head to the deafening music and nudged her snoring boyfriend with an elbow.
Huh?
The burly biker came awake and blinked a few times before looking in the direction she was indicating. Grinning widely, he stood, exposing a lean, muscular frame draped in a grimy t-shirt decorated with the rebel flag of the Southern Confederation. Nazi tattoos on both arms. The silver buckle of his belt was a screaming demon skull.
Well,
Look what we got here. Who let in the garbage?
Without a word, Zalhares swung up the Uru and put a burst into the biker's face. His skull and brains blowing out through his mane of greasy hair. The Brazilian mercenaries cut loose. Relaxing his tense shoulders, Zalhares slung his automatic and drew his imbel pistol to stand guard while the others reloaded.
Dog, Georgina, Recon. Minas, check for possums playing dead.
Sure thing. Oh, sneaky, sneaky.
Clear?
Clear.
Good.
Zalhares righted a stool and took a seat.
Minas, Georgina, stand guard. Watch for army helicopters. I need to use my computer.
While the others took post at the windows, Mariano ran the power cord to an outlet. Zalhares attached the phone line to the wall jack.
Time to become rich.